Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to the Midsters Podcast, your podcast for inspiration on being bold and making the most of your midlife. Today we have a very special guest, our friend Kim Heckler, who has just published her first book. It's a biography of her mother-in-law, Margaret Heckler. And the book, you can see it here, is A Woman of Firsts, Margaret Heckler, Political Trailblazer. So welcome, Kim.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're so excited to have you here. I kind of wanted to start here. So Margaret Heckler was the first female congresswoman from Massachusetts.
In her own right. In other words, she didn't follow a deceased husband into the Congress.
Right. She won on her own, and she beat a 42-year incumbent?
She did. Joseph Martin was an institution for the Republican Party, having served 42 years in the Congress and being Speaker of the House twice.
Wow. So when you met her, Kim, where was she in her professional journey? Because she accomplished a lot. Where was she in that journey when you first met her?
So she was ambassador to Ireland when I met her in 88, visiting Ireland when she was there at Deerfield, which is the ambassador's residence in Phoenix Park.
So between the being a congresswoman from Massachusetts and being ambassador to Ireland, she was also Secretary of Health and Human Services under President Reagan, right?
Yes. One of the first women in his cabinet. So and one of the first women to hold that position, especially coming in. It was HHS held the third largest budget in the world. So the first largest budget in the world was the entire federal budget. The second was the entire budget of the Soviet Union. And the third was Margaret Heckler's budget, Health and Human Services, which at that point comprised the Department of Education, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, NIH, CDC, you know, and 350 other departments. So it far bypassed the Department of Defense.
What a big job.
It was massive. 145,000 employees were under her, and the third largest budget where things needed to be allocated. How much goes here? How much goes here? And so she was at the top of that.
You know, what's interesting to me about that, and I hadn't thought about this until just this minute, mm-hmm. her training was as a lawyer.
Yes.
But essentially, she's running a business.
Yes.
So it's extraordinary. What did she draw on to be able to, like, take on that role?
Because she was a congresswoman, she learned how to get things done, especially because she did it in such a bipartisan way.
Mm.
She represented Massachusetts for 16 years. And as a moderate Republican, most of her constituents were Democrats. And so she was very service-oriented toward them. They had a lot of needs that might not have been the case in other parts of the country. Fall River, for instance, southern Massachusetts, there were a lot of factory workers that were Portuguese and women that needed to work and got paid by piecemeal. So she was able to see their health needs and the health needs of her constituents, which she at veterans, she was on Veterans Affairs as one of her many different committees that she joined as a congresswoman. And so that transferred easily when she became Secretary of Health and Human Services. Mm. She understood the needs of the American people.
Well, I think women in general, too, there's this quiet power of empathy that women can bring to the table. They can see the bigger picture sometimes. Nothing against men, but I do think it is a superpower of a woman to be able to step into that and to look at things differently in a more nurturing, more empathetic way. And it sounds like that was Margaret Heckler.
It really was. Margaret was given away at birth by Irish immigrant parents in New York City. So that empathy started early for her. She had no mother tucking her in at night. She was taken in by an Irish Catholic widow, much older in her life, but suffering from the Great Depression, and so took in this child because her parents actually paid a pittance every month for this woman to take their baby 3 days after her birth, basically, until she was up for the rest of her life. She never again belonged to her parents. So what grew out of that wound, if you will, was a tremendous amount of empathy, knowing that you were unwanted, you rooted for her as she got into her positions because you knew she was the voice for people with no voice.
Right. She also developed a tremendous amount of resilience. And I think you need that to be in politics. But do you think that was innate in her or a product of what she went through in her upbringing? Because she also had, it's kind of an interesting story, and I recommend the book because it's really quite an interesting story.
Thank you.
A mix of deprivation, if you will, because she wasn't raised in her own home. Mm-hmm. But then these extraordinary opportunities came her way through people that she met as she grew older, the school she went to. And I'm just curious, because you knew her, she's your mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. Was it something innate in her, do you think, or just that she had this very unusual upbringing that led her to be so tough and resilient and yet very empathetic and kind?
Mm-hmm. And driven.
And driven.
Like she's
driven.
Very professionally driven.
Yes, I think that being in that home with not just Belinda West, the woman that raised her, but the widows that were the sisters of Belinda West, she was in a home with older, industrious women with no rights, right? Mm-hmm. So they lived in a home. They had no right to credit. They had no rights, basically. Margaret saw this, and they were not necessarily who she aspired to become in terms of her profession. She also didn't have a mother or father saying, I'm a lawyer, you be a lawyer, right? So she came across this, one thing led to another, as she said, and she did feel very divinely directed in her path. But I believe those industrious women that raised her had a part in her coming later into her life and saying, what can I do to write or change an era, help to change an era for women because of what I experienced? And then simply being a survivalist, that mode allowed her to reach the top echelon of education.
Mm.
And so when she went to all-girl Catholic schools in New York City on scholarship, she was pulled out by the nuns to say, we're having people come and look at our school this weekend. The UN has just started. We have a lot of people from Latin America wanting to send their daughters to New York City to this beautiful school. Will you give the current events? So they would hand her Time Magazine and Newsweek's, and she would study it, read it, and then present before a prospective audience of parents. And so it allowed her in that experience to do public speaking.
Mm.
And that public, one thing led to the other. And then when she decided to go to law school, that was a game changer for her because she had gone from all women education.
Yeah.
To all men.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Law school, she was the only woman and the second woman to graduate from BC Law. And that was after Harvard Law accepted her, but didn't want her because she was a woman. So she came before Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she wouldn't have known it at the time. Neither did Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Margaret came before Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but their paths were similar.
Hmm.
They both grew up in New York. They both aspired to be lawyers. They both had husbands that supported their law career. Mm-hmm. And both entered the highest levels in American government. So all of those steps helped her and empowered her, that all male audience and the teachers calling on her just as much as they called on the men, the professors. She said, I can get to the answer as quickly as they can. And then it ended up going to an all-male Congress, right? So she had just experienced that audience. And yes, there were 10 women, but it was 10 women, 523
men. Right.
So, so she had to be bold and she, you know, and so it is that striking American story, really, yeah, that really all is. Women and all daughters, granddaughters should read, because it's not just her history. It's our history. It's women's history on the backs of a visionary.
And I think one of the things that's really beautiful about her story is that you said she was a moderate Republican.
Yes.
In the sense that we really don't see anymore. I mean, she had some conservative values and she, you know,
yes,
followed Reagan's political career and mm-hmm. was part of his cabinet. But she also was very much a feminist. I mean, she
was
perhaps because of her upbringing and the respect that she had for the single women that raised her, she did a lot for women.
She certainly did. And it was coming in and being the only woman on all of her committees, and especially the Banking and Currency Committee. And that story is so unique because she comes in with 37 men. Now, when you're a congressman and you decide what committee that you're going to join, chances are perhaps in your life before being a congressman, you were a banker, mm-hmm. right? A financial guy. So you join the Banking and Currency Committee and you can contribute there. So for her, she joins there with an idea in the back of her head. We're going to write a law here mm-hmm. for women to get credit cards, home mortgages in their own name.
I just want to stop there and say women did not. And I think that that's actually something that comes up on TikTok all the time. Women before that point, and this is what,
1974,
women could not have credit in their own name. They had to have a husband or a father co-sign for them. And she changed that.
She changed that. And so she changed an era.
So she had no boundaries. Like she saw no boundaries for women. I'm curious also, because of the survival story, where do you think that she got her confidence to sit in those rooms with all those men in a place that she had never, not only had she ever been there, no one had been there before. Because I would think coming from being given away, mm-hmm. and that's so sad to say, that would change the way you feel about yourself, the self-confidence, the self-esteem. But as you explain how she lived her life and very outwardly, like she wanted to do things for other people. She wanted to change the landscape. That takes confidence. Where do you think she got that?
You know, if you're not growing, you're dying. And I think for her, it was just always the upward climb to prove to herself that she was all right.
That's wonderful.
And I think that might have been innately where that came from.
And our motivations come from different places. That's why I was curious about it. The other question that I had, because I know you are in awe of your mother-in-law, and I can't imagine, and I don't know if you remember, it was probably about 10 years ago, we were on the Eastern Shore, and it was like a late summer afternoon, and I was with friends from out of town, my husband and I, and we bumped into you and you invited us back to your home on the Eastern Shore. And I remember walking into your home and there was this, appeared to be this sweet lady sitting in a chair. She had a blanket on her. Mm-hmm. She was by the fireplace. You introduced us. We ended up in a wonderful conversation. And it came up that you had spent some time, well, you always spent time with her, but in particular, trying to find the nuances of her story and how she lived in her career and how she was in her career. And I remember just asking her a few questions. She was so humble. Like, I did not know until later who I was in the presence of.
Mm-hmm.
And you were humble about her as well. I mean, you definitely talked about her story, and I know you were in awe with her, but she was just so humble. Was she always that way? It seems like a quiet, humble, but yet she would have had to be loud and powerful in other ways to have done what she did.
It is interesting how she was able to be both powerful when there was a battle
mm-hmm.
and vulnerable underneath because of her childhood. And so that vulnerability is what allowed her and I to get together and have a beautiful relationship. I was not intimidated by her. She spent zero time telling me through me birthing my children and her coming over and being grandma and sitting and giving out candy on Halloween so we could take our kids out. She never talked about, well, I wrote this law and I, you know, and my team at HHS wrote the first federalized hospice program for all women, all people to get hospice under Medicare. Yeah, I mean, it was just there is a litany of things that she did. And I didn't really know that. Yes, I saw her as the ambassador to Ireland. And in that role, she was mighty. And I got to see her almost like the Queen of England, who she dealt with, Margaret Thatcher.
Right.
The Queen, you know. Yeah, she did all those things. But when we were with her and she was with my husband, who she adored, she was able to just lay back and be, you could see right through her. You could see Margaret Heckler.
Was there one specific moment that occurred that you were like, I have to write her story?
There were probably two. Mm-hmm. One of them is a former HHS secretary, Alex Azar, was going to be visiting my husband. And before he came, he said, let me get a book on her and read, because he was HHS secretary and she was. He covered COVID as HHS secretary. She covered AIDS. So they both had a pandemic on their watch.
Oh, wow.
And they were very different. And Margaret's was fatal. Mm-hmm. So you got right. AIDS and you died. So hers was much more traumatic. And it led to the help of a faster vaccine because of the work that happened 50 years prior with Margaret at HHS and her team at NIH. Fauci worked under her. But the point is, he said to me, I need to go and find a book on Margaret Heckler so I can be ready to spend some time with John Heckler. And he couldn't find one.
Oh. And you were already writing it at the time, though.
I was interviewing her.
Yeah.
The chapters were not put into any semblance at that point. But I was interviewing her.
I remember that 10 years ago.
Yes. Yes.
Let me ask you this, Kim, because you worked with your sister-in-law.
I did.
Her, Margaret's oldest daughter, Linda.
Yes.
Who is named after the woman that raised Margaret.
Correct.
In writing this book, she was like your support system, basically. Mm-hmm.
Still is.
I'm just curious why you wrote the book and she didn't write the book. Do you think that there being a daughter-in-law as opposed to a daughter made a difference in perspective, or was it just you had the reins and you ran with it? Or, I mean, it was a collaborative process, but I'm interested in how you took the lead.
So I took the lead because I do have that drive, that natural drive to get things done. I'm solution-based and I'm task-based. I asked the daughters if they wanted to do it with me. And the one daughter, you know, everyone's busy. And so one daughter was doing this in her life and writing her own book. And Belinda said, I will come alongside you, but I will not take the lead. And so, and for my husband, for heaven's sakes, I mean, even him opening up the table of contents and reading the chapter names, he's crying, you know. Aww. So there's a lot of emotion when they are reading it. And Belinda has been extremely easy to work with and non-emotional, in that she's been able to separate the fact that this is her mother and we're doing this for history's sake and for America's sake.
Have you been able to just sit back in the stillness of it all, because I know it's been busy, and realize what you've done and be able to see the pride that your family has for you in doing this and honoring Margaret in such a way?
I'm trying to, but no, it's just been too busy for the last 2 months. It's been a whirlwind. It's almost like a wedding. You put all this time in and then you have it and you're like, oh my goodness. But I am having my cup filled. My emotions are high when I have events. When I do things like this, because it reminds me that in our polarized times, we need the story of Margaret Heckler more than ever.
Mm, I agree
with
you.
We need it. Her story is not a Republican story or a Democrat story.
No, it's not.
It's an American story.
And it's also politics as politics should be,
yes,
aimed at actually accomplishing things. She accomplished a great deal.
Because she was able to cross the aisle easily.
Right. And willing to cross the aisle.
Willing. Most of her friends were on the left.
Mm.
And so it just happened to be that when she came into Congress in 67 as the only newly elected woman to Congress, 70 men and Margaret Heckler coming in with George H.W. Bush.
Mm,
he was the president of their freshman class. She would be the vice president. And she just came in and didn't realize it at the time, but she was rewriting history for women. Mm-hmm. And
she was setting a tone and a path. I have another question for you, mm-hmm, though, about Margaret. If Margaret were alive today, if she was here, mm-hmm, and she had this opportunity to read this book, what would you hope would be her thoughts about you writing this book for her? And what do you think it would be? You knew her.
I think she would be pleased that her compassion came out, that it wasn't just about all of her accomplishments. She definitely would also see, hopefully, that her greatest accomplishments for all Americans, whether they were Black, white, gay, straight, Republican, Democrat, none of that matters. For her, it was the love of the American people. And I think that shines through in the book.
It does.
And all of her constituents, and as Secretary of Health, one of the greatest positions to have, because we're only as good as our health allows. Mm-hmm. And so she being there, it was hard for her under the Reagan administration, the first ultra-conservative administration for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And to make AIDS the number one health issue when it wasn't really spoken of in the kitchen cabinet, if you will.
I think health equity is still an issue in our country, for sure.
It is.
But it sounds like she was empathetic to everybody, and she tried to equalize that somewhat, no matter if people had insurance or whatever, finances or resources to help themselves in a health way. And again, I have to say, I think there's something with women and empathy and, mm-hmm, being able to look outwardly at other people and nurture and care for. And I love that piece that comes out of Margaret.
I think you're right. I know Jackie White, who helped me because Jackie was one of her assistants when she was HHS secretary and working on the hospice issue. She said because she was a woman and because of her heart, she got done more than all of the other HHS secretaries that Jackie had worked under. And so that femininity, that love for people and that empathy allowed her to go a long way. She was also Irish, and the charm was, and she looked like Debbie Reynolds, which people don't know who that is today, but she was that small power source,
yeah,
that because she was a lawyer as well, she came with knowledge. And so there were not empty words. When she said something, it made sense to people.
Right. And she spoke intentionally.
She spoke intentionally.
Yeah. So as Marianne alluded to, you know, when she met your mother-in-law years ago, you were already in the process of writing this book. It took you a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And for folks who read the book, there's a ton of research that went into this. It's not just, oh, this is my mother-in-law and I talked to her. You did a lot of interviews. You did a lot of research. How did you find the time and energy to take on this project in the way that you did? With full commitment. I mean, you were fully committed to this project.
Mm-hmm. And you were raising a family.
And you were raising a family of three kids.
And very involved in the community.
Well, I was into real estate and realized that I didn't want to take that down the road of weekend showing properties and not being elsewhere with my family, for instance. And so I decided that I'm going to take a break over there and focus over here. And a lot of the work that I was able to do was at my home, but also I was tasked with emptying her local area storage units, which are in Arlington around the corner from my home, like right down from Moby Dick.
What a treasure trove.
Oh, it was, that is, you asked the question and I said there were two reasons I asked the book. The one was that Alex Azar, a former HHS secretary, said there's no book on Margaret Heckler. And I felt that the story needed to be told. But the 250 boxes that are for papers that are stored at Boston College did not seem attractive to me because I didn't want to necessarily say, okay, I want to know more about LBJ, or I wanted to go know more about why she voted to impeach Nixon. You know, pull out all those boxes and let me fly to Boston College and let me get a hotel. I got in my own boxes in that storage bin. They were 10 feet high in a 12 by 12 foot room, two of those rooms. And when I opened a box that might have had old curlers or a pen that didn't work, great. I was able to just discard that easily. But I'm literally, and I have pictures of me, sitting on all of these boxes around with a pull light, you know, and cold sometimes in my dirty down jacket. And I'm just reading these papers about these five Black health professional doctors that met with her her third day as HHS secretary, saying African Americans and minorities are dying up to 8 years earlier than whites. And this is unfair. There's not enough of our hospitals and even Black professors, medical doctors that are teaching about the fact that we have innate reasons that we're dying younger. This should be brought to the attention of the American government, of the Health and Human Services Secretary. These type of papers is, and I'm looking at these and I'm seeing, and then there's names of Dr. Lewis Sullivan, who was the one that was in the charge for that, that met with Margaret with these other doctors. And I'm then calling him and asking for an interview. And he said, well, absolutely. It was like her third or fourth day on the job and she's listening. And he's saying it's not going to go anywhere. She's probably not going to put funding toward, you know, offices of minority health or to try to. And we got the Heckler report, which I found in these boxes, the nine volumes of the Heckler report, which helped close the gap of death or increase the longevity for all Americans.
It's the health equity. Being from a healthcare background, I have to tell you, that's probably the most inspiring thing. When I think about Margaret Heckler, is that she had that lens. And not only did she have that lens, she made it happen. She started the path. We still have a lot more to do, but she definitely put us on the path.
She certainly did. And she did it because when she would meet with people like this group of gentlemen, and one of them would say, I remember the interview with one of the men. They said, Margaret said, oh, I have a Black dentist in Boston. And one of the gentlemen said, well, you must be talking about Dr. Walker, because there's only one Black dentist in all of Boston.
Wow.
And so the light went on in Margaret's head, and everything else they said, they were looking at her thinking, maybe nothing. But she was thinking, this will change.
Yeah.
And so it was those individual touch points with people. It was some of her press secretaries or that were gay that made her put AIDS as the number one health issue. She had such compassion toward ordinary people that that would not have necessarily had the lift on their own. Women in the Nixon administration in positions of power or middle management, even, there were no women in those positions. And so as one of four Republican congresswomen, she went into the Oval Office. He would have never met with the Democrat congresswomen, but he finally approved that meeting. It took a while, 6 months. And he and they came in front of him and said, this should not be. They should be interviewed based on their qualifications. But if they are as qualified, you should make a change here, and you're the one to do it. and now is the time. And he did it. He hired Barbara Franklin, and thousands of women got into the Nixon administration because of that meeting with the four women that are known as the Tiny But Mighty.
Yeah.
How was it? I mean, you're married to her son. What does he say? Like, what was it like to be a son? Yeah, yeah. A child of Margaret Heckler. I mean, he's the male. It sounds like he didn't have any brothers. They were just sisters. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious of what he took away from that. And the pride he must have in you. Leslie Ann and I were talking earlier, and we were talking about the title. Leslie Ann talked about the title, A Woman of First. But she said, actually, there's two women of first today.
You're a first
because this is your first book. Mm-hmm. So your husband's seeing that as well, as are your children. But I'm curious about what your husband thinks, you know, what his thoughts are on being raised by Margaret Heckler. But also, gosh, she's got to have so much pride.
Well, thank you very much. He loved living in that world. He was six when Margaret became a congresswoman. And he had two older sisters that also mothered him. And there was always a woman in the house that was cooking for them and, you know, making chicken and, you know, just tickling his toes as he woke up in the morning. And Margaret saw them in the morning. She had dinner with him every night, albeit sometimes it was much later. And there were many bowls of Captain Crunch cereal before dinner. Mm. But he got into sports. He went to all boys schools at Bullis in Potomac. And so he was on all the sports team, came home tired. When mom came home, it was hugs and how was your day? So he grew up thinking in one conversation at the dinner table, it was cute because he made some remark that when I grow older, I want to be president. And his sister, Allison, his older sister, said, "You can't be president, silly. You're a boy."
So great story. That says a lot.
Yeah.
Yes. So they saw their mother and they did go to Amy Carter's birthday parties and they went to the White House often for church on Sundays with the Nixons and White House Christmas parties. And Margaret, John danced with Nancy Reagan while his mother danced with Ronald Reagan. And Nancy's had her head crooked the whole time. Not interested in my husband, but very much interested in watching Margaret dance with Ronald Reagan. So
parallel question to that is how have your children responded to your writing this book? Because this book, it's not just a really for the public, right? It's also an act of love for your family. Mm-hmm. So how have your kids responded to that and to your accomplishment in completing this?
You know, it's so cute. My kids just transferred their sailboat, all three of them. Libby came home for the weekend to do it because she's at Virginia Tech. They sailed from Easton all the way to Old Town Alexandria to keep their boat in Old
I
Town.
Saw the pictures. I loved it, the videos.
And one of the videos that I didn't post is while Amanda is sailing the boat and my son is kind of just sitting up there relaxing, Libby is reading chapter 9 and out loud to the three kids. And it just warms my heart.
That's fabulous.
That they are all reading it. My mom just finished it. She loved it. My husband is like on chapter 10 or 11. And yeah, I think they're seeing grandma differently.
Yeah.
They saw her very differently during that time. She was formal. And so you come into any home where kids are in sweaty soccer clothes and cleats at the front door, right? When she came to dinner and, you know, and she wanted them dressing up for her. And she had Amanda Irish dancing, you know, through the house, entertaining her. And
well, they see you differently, too.
They do.
As an author.
They do. Yeah. They do. And so, yeah, every morning I'm signing books for my kids' friends. And so it's happening, but it's happening in a pace that we all can just absorb together.
But what a gift to your family.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Thank you.
It's incredible, Kim.
I haven't even really been able to take on that
right
at this point. It really has been just a tremendous outpouring of support everywhere, just like in this opportunity.
I have one last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
What advice from your own experience writing this book and from what you know about your mother-in-law having written this book about her, what advice would you give to women about how to live their life boldly and with inspiration?
I would say that Margaret's life showed courage and conviction and compassion. And we are living in a time where even our children are not as convicted about things. They're very much on social media. They're not reading history. They're very much gaming. They're very much into their own worlds. People are about winning today. Mm-hmm. It's a different mentality. It's not as much about doing to lift others up. People are more about lifting themselves up, if you will. And so we've trained them that way when everyone got a trophy at every game. And, you know, so it's the product now is what people are reaching for, they're missing. They're missing the big picture. And so what I would say is Margaret's greatest accomplishments were for all people, not just women, but to look at people not in a partisan way, that we need to get back to looking at people as people and realizing that the answer is somewhere in the middle and that we are going to appreciate and respect them, get back to civility and get back to respect.
Love that, Kim. Thank you so much. It's been great having you.
Thank you both.
Oh, very inspirational. Wonderful. Yeah, really great. And for our listeners, the book is A Woman of First, Margaret Heckler, Political Trailblazer. And you should pick up a copy and give it a good read.
And it's on Audible now as well.
Oh, how wonderful. Even better. And you'll find a link on our Instagram pages, The American Midsters and The Midsters Podcast. We look forward to you tuning in next time.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.